Anonymous denonymized and arrested. Google Plus to rule them all. And the Department of Justice gets your decrypted data. All that and more on the Slongcast. Welcome to the Slongcast, episode 39 for Tuesday, July 19th, 2011. It's July 19th. Can you believe that?
Yeah, it's year's almost half over.
I know.
No, the year is half over.
It's half over. That, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ryan Lancey, seated to my right. We are both back after my absence last week in Vegas.
It's weird how I'm seated to your right and you're seated to my left.
I know, right?
How's that possible? Actually, you're also seated to my right.
It's mind-boggling. Just got that.
Yeah.
So, top story of the week. This is actually breaking news. Just happened.
Breaking news on the Slongcast?
Breaking news! Beep, 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 beep.
Where's Guy Smiley?
Oh, Guy Smiley. Barometers are falling sharply. Hold on. Do I have a beep in the sound? No, I don't have a beep. Well, I have that. I can, like, run a lot of those together. But, yeah, it just happened a little bit after lunchtime. The story from the Atlantic Wire. The FBI confirms arrests in the anonymous hacking case. Apparently, they've arrested, or claimed to have arrested, a lot of people. The count is up to about 16 now that they have arrested claiming to be in anonymous. And they say that there are some 40-some search warrants nationwide. This is kind of crazy because it seems that for the longest time, Anonymous was very good at being anonymous. You know, they trained their people well on how to use proxies and evade detection. And now all of a sudden, the FBI's got them. I mean, I don't know what this means to anything, but there's really no more news than that. I don't know if you have anything to add, Ryan.
Not really. Just that you can't hide from the FBI.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, literally, this story just broke today, and information is still coming in. So, other than knowing that Anonymous is on their radar and being taken out one by one, hopefully next week we'll have some more information on this and see what actually happens. Maybe Anonymous and LulzSec will be no more. The old top story. What was the top story of the week until the FBI cracked down on Anonymous was this article from the Next Web. And I found this to be interesting. Why Windows 8 is the end of Windows as you know it. Basic gist of this article, Microsoft is trying to go to One OS everywhere. Ryan, I know you're a Windows guy. What do you think about this? Seems like a big strategic shift in the way they do things.
Well, I mean, I thought the Windows 8 interface was, you know, interesting. It's basically the Windows Phone interface on the Windows desktop platform,
right.
So, you know, mostly. And they're doing this whole, like, full screen app push.
Yeah, which I want to get your opinion on that. Do you like, because I personally hate the full screen app push toward that.
I guess since they're maintaining, like, the ability to run a standard Windows desktop, I don't care. It's kind of like how, you know, in Windows 98 and Windows XP, they started integrating like this like HTML view of your folders in Windows Explorer. You know, and they changed the desktop and different things that you could do, active desktop and whatnot. And it was, for me, it was like, I don't care. I'm just going to use it the way I've always used it. Because they always have at least, they have always preserved like the last best interface, it seems like.
You could always go back a step.
Yeah, or even more. Like, you can still kind of skin it back to the way it looked in Windows 95 if you really want to.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty afraid of this whole full screen push because it seems like everybody's doing it. You know, Apple already does it. You know, they were the first ones to push that on mobile devices, and now everybody does it. But that's basically how mobile devices work. You know, one app takes up the whole screen. But now everybody.
I mean, I don't think that's a precedent from Apple. I think
it's just the way they work.
Yeah.
But it seems like now manufacturers are taking, or not manufacturers, but software vendors are taking that to the desktop. And
yeah,
I mean, if you look at my desktop right now, I have three windows open at the same time. This is just how I normally work. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want one window to take my whole screen.
Yeah.
But sorry, I cut you off with your whole statement there.
Oh, well, I think that interface, from what I've seen, it's interesting. I think it lends itself to be able to be installed on multiple classes of devices, phones, tablets, desktops, 10-foot
interface. It's a very touchy interface.
Yeah, I could see it working well with Kinect. I could see it working well with Touch. I can see it working well with the mouse.
That's something I never thought of, Kinect.
Yeah, for like a 10-foot interface, I could see them, using it for that. You know, in terms of like it being the end, they say the title of the article was "The End is End of Windows as You Know It." I don't know if that's really the case. Like, I mean, it definitely isn't a start menu, and it definitely isn't, icons on a desktop, which is basically what Apple offers, and what Windows has been to date.
That's what every OS is.
Pretty much, yeah. It's probably the biggest shift in like overall UI since the start menu was introduced, because that's something that even like really no other OS really offers or didn't offer. Linux window managers now kind of provide that interface where you have a start menu sort of launcher.
But yeah, they kind of mimicked the whole Windows-ish look.
Right. But, Apple still has basically everything's launched off their little, what's that bar called?
The dock.
The dock, or, an icon on your desktop.
Do you actually remember, this was something that Sun did a while ago. This was at least 7 years ago. I believe it was called their Glass, or maybe Looking Glass interface. It was a 3D, like the first ever 3D desktop interface. And that kind of reminds me of what Microsoft is doing here, where it was nothing like the icon and start menu approach. It didn't go anywhere. It fell flat.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember that. I don't know that I've ever had any experience with it. But sometimes these pay off and sometimes they don't. There's been some comparison of the Windows 8, interface. Really, it's the Windows Phone 7 interface, in my opinion.
That's exactly
I don't
it,
know
yeah.
why they don't call it that. To me, that's where the paradigm started, in my opinion, but that Metro interface. But I think that, there's been some comparison of that change from the command prompt to a GUI. That this is the first, like, really touch interface, the UI, where like, icons lend themselves to touch because if they're big enough and they're arranged correctly on the screen,
right, spaced far enough apart.
Yeah, I mean, so they do lend themselves to that, and the iPhone is taking advantage of that. Inside the apps themselves, it's up to the app developer how they want to make it touch based.
Yeah, and that's,
there's never really been any controls provided by Windows that are like touch centric, with maybe the exception of like the ribbon. I've always felt that ribbon was their like maybe their first step in the touch direction. It's definitely better organized for touch as compared to a file menu.
Yeah, everything. They still kind of cram the options in there, but it's definitely more placed. It's placed weller, better. That you can have bigger buttons.
It might not work on a 7-inch display, but on like a 17-inch display, like those HP Touch Smarts, I think I could see it working.
Do you see this failing in terms of the app developers? Like you said, that it's up to each individual application to, Windows can make the OS be completely touch-based, but if all the apps don't follow, then kind of screwed.
Well, I think app developers are going to target their audience. I don't see Photoshop changing their interface to be touch-based. Maybe there would be some elements that would be touch-based. Maybe it would be like a sort of a third or a second method of, well, I guess it'd be third, keyboard, mouse, and then this like touch way of doing things.
Yeah.
But I don't see them like revamping the interface. But yet, I can also see people, maybe game developers, starting to, use the touch interface. And what I was getting at, that it's up to the app developers, I think it should be up to the app developers. It's not that Microsoft's left them hanging. I'm sure they're still going to provide them an API to use the touch features of the OS. you know, rather than, you know, well, code right. it from scratch
yeah.
or something.
No, I would assume that, you know, 100%. I just don't, I don't know whether it's going to be like quick adoption. You know, Windows 8 comes out, and how long is it going to be until the apps catch up and people have this disdain for the whole interface because, oh, my OS is touch, but none of the apps are for the first year. You know, how many people are going to get mad?
I think that, you know, when the OS is delivered on tablets, I think if there's an app developer that wants to develop for a tablet, they're going to release a touch-based app. But if there's a developer, like I said, like photo, you know, Adobe with Photoshop, or you know, maybe like I'm trying to think of like, you know,
like Final Cut
like
Pro,
Cubase or something.
Yeah, there's always going to be those edge cases.
That... Yeah, they're, you know, their user base is going to be mouse keyboard oriented, and they're going to stick with that. So I just think it leaves it up to the developer to decide.
Do you happen to know offhand what language Windows Phone apps are written in?
I don't. I mean, I think it supports all the .NET languages.
That's what I was thinking. Like, if somebody were to write a tablet or phone app, how hard would it be to run it on a computer?
That I don't know. And I don't think that you know, apps are cross compatible right now. I don't know that maybe they will be. Maybe Windows Phone 8 will just be a port of Windows 8 to the phone, because they're saying that the hardware will be developed enough that Windows will actually be a lightweight OS by that point.
Right.
Because they don't plan on making the hardware requirements higher. I know that the Windows 8 stuff is supposed to be Java and HTML5, and I'm fairly certain that Windows Phone 7 is not Java and HTML5 as the primary. I mean, it might support it.
But yeah, I can almost say for certain that it's not Java. I think everything runs HTML5 to a point. I mean, it's just HTML, but whether they support like the super
features.
Yeah.
Well, I just mean like as their main.
Oh, right. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Do you remember hearing when Windows 8 is scheduled to come out? Because it's in beta right now, right?
Yeah, I think they're planning on a summer 2012 release, I thought is what I read.
Yeah, like MSDN developers can get it now, right?
I don't know. I haven't checked. I don't know.
I thought I read that if you had an MSDN subscription, you could get in on the whatever they call the pre-betas or whatever now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure. I think they were talking like release candidate like after Christmas.
That's cool.
Something like that, or you know, like probably spring, I would imagine. Yeah. If they're going for like a summer release, summer fall release.
So there's the call to all app developers now. If you develop an app for Windows, start developing for the APIs that Microsoft has out for Windows 8, because it's coming.
Yeah, I just wonder how they'll do it.
Yeah,
because I just don't know how Visual Studio was going to support. I mean.
Well, I think that's an edge case, you know.
Well, there's a lot of worry in the whole industry about whether they've left developers out, you know.
Just high end people in general, whether it's software developers, video people, you know, artists, you know, the people who use the Final Cuts, the Photoshops, the Visual Studios.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. Maybe they're going to pull an Apple and go completely consumer-based. Our next article comes to us from CNET. This is something we've been talking about for a very long time, the net neutrality rules. You know, it's always just been, hey, we want to implement net neutrality, and everybody argues about it. Nothing's ever happened. Well, it seems that last week, the FCC registered their net neutrality rules with the Office of Management and Budget. And this is... I don't want to say the first, but maybe the next step in making these rules official. And it pissed off Verizon and Comcast and all the other companies who don't want net neutrality to go into effect. What do you think now? I think these rules are actually going to be adopted, and these companies are going to be forced to, you know, not discriminate traffic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... I've been in support of the net neutrality rules. I mean, I think maybe some of it might go a little too far. And I'm still not sure about wireless networks, because I think there's a special edge case there where the bandwidth just does not physically exist yet.
You're saying like phone wireless or laptop wireless?
Phone wireless.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, there's just a limited amount of... Even assuming, 4G's out there, we know it's out there. It's just not everywhere yet.
Right.
And, you know, if they're not careful on what they, I mean, it's weird. Like TCP/IP you know, has end-to-end congestion control, and it should balance like connections and all that stuff. But it might, I think it's well within a phone company's right to say, we don't support any video on such and such like level of connection. Like, if your connection drops below a certain point.
So if you're 3G or below, no video.
Yeah, we're just not going to support video because it's just, you just get caught up too much acts and knacks, and it overwhelms the network, you know, or it just makes it useless. It doesn't even provide a good user experience, so why try?
Well, if they do it that way, they're idiots. You know, video should be UDP anyways with no acts whatsoever.
Well, it's not their fault. It's all about the source of the media.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. Not necessarily Verizon or Comcast, but the people distributing video should be smart enough.
Right, but the UDP is still gonna waste bandwidth, I think. You know, I mean, if it's UDP.
Oh, it's not gonna shrink the size. It'll just limit the, because there's no acts.
Oh, I know what you mean there. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's connectionless. But what I'm saying is like, it's really about just the overhead involved. It's not even overhead. It's
multicast.
Like multicast would be good. But even still, like, even if you wanted to stream video, like, let's say on like a 1X RTT connection or Edge,
right,
you can't do it.
Not going to happen.
I mean, if you want like 15 frames a second at like 100 by 200 pixels, right, maybe.
What was that? If you want stop motion,
yeah,
then yes. Yeah, that's
my only thing. I think the wireless, they should allow some discretion, I think, in the wireless.
Or maybe they could push and be like, 4G will be out over the entire country at the time that this gets adopted. You know, maybe the FCC has some push there. And it's cool because, you know, this is like the first official thing we've heard. They've been talking about it for a while. We've assumed that because it was the FCC that they were going to happen eventually, but now like they're registering it, they're putting it in motion, it's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's another part of this too. Like, even with 4G, you just get to a point where, you know, there are laws of physics that which cannot be surpassed at this point in terms of like tower density and you know, per square mile versus like how many people have phones. And if you want to maintain basic emergency services, like just being able to make a phone call or 911, then they have to be able to have the ability to like throttle the network for certain things for those situations. Like, I think, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there should be every carrier, if they don't do QoS for the 911 calls, if when somebody dials 911,
yeah,
there isn't
QoS,
a QoS bit set to push that packet through no matter what else is on that line,
yeah,
that should, like, they should do that.
Well, I hope they would. And we're really just talking about them throttling specific companies,
right,
not specific technologies. But I think they should be allowed to throttle specific technologies. And I'm not sure how the net neutrality stuff's written, but it may come down to, oh, only this company provides this technology. So in essence, if you throttle that technology, you're throttling that company. So there's a fine line that I think they're going to have to work. You know, here's a perfect example. Like, you go out to a concert in Burgettstown, PA, which is outside Pittsburgh, for anyone who's not from the area.
It's West Virginia, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's it's right on the border there. And that's the big concert venue for Pittsburgh. It's an amphitheater. They probably have like three towers out there because normally there's no one out there.
But when there's a concert
20,000, 25,000 people show up. And you can't get cell service.
It's freaking Woodstock out there when there's a concert.
Yeah, and you can't get cell service. I want to know that when I pay for a service that I get good service everywhere. But even, I mean, I'm not going to expect a telephone company to put up a bunch of towers out there just for an hour-long event.
See, I am.
Or 2 hours.
You know, like, that's the event place of Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah, but
you need to do this.
6 months of the year, it's not used. It's snowing.
I don't care.
Well,
if they want that to be the place, then maybe the music venues or whoever owns that land should contribute some sort of money to the cell carriers.
They're under no obligation to provide service everywhere for you.
They're not, but they should.
Well, they should, but I mean, I think competition is going to be begat that. Like, that's where I think the competition comes in. It's like, well, you know, if this company does it better and you don't like the fact that your Netflix downloads are getting throttled while you're at a concert, then switch providers.
Right. Yeah, and speaking of that, you know, I was just in Vegas this past week, and my cell phone, I don't want to say didn't work. 3G didn't work. I had to turn off 3G on my phone and go back down to Edge because it was just saturated with so many people, and I basically didn't surf the internet on my phone for an entire week because of that. It was horrible. But you know, speaking about them being able to, you know, force companies to not discriminate traffic and, you know, streaming video, blah blah blah. We remember a while ago that I believe it was France implemented the three strikes rule on internet usage, specifically infringing on copyrights like downloading torrents of movies and whatever. Well, it seems like the US doing the same thing, except they're like, oh, we're going to three up you. It's not three strikes. We're going to give you six strikes. Personally, I think this is the dumbest thing ever. Like, really? Six strikes? What about 10 strikes? What about one strike? Let's just pick some arbitrary number and say, we'll give you this many times to be illegal. Like, I think the way they're going about this is just stupid. I mean, there's got to be some better way, right?
Right. Well, I thought I read, and it wasn't in this article from Ars, it was another one, that that the strikes won't result in you being banned. That it's more of a notification thing.
I would think that after the sixth strike, they're going to do something to you. I mean, they don't say.
Well, it says there's no requirement that ISPs disconnect a user's internet connection at any point. And indeed, ISPs say they will refuse any measure that might cut off a user's phone service, email access, or any security or health service, such as home security or medical monitoring. But ISPs are free to disconnect users if they wish.
Yeah, I mean, this is also...
But they've always been able to do that.
Right. And I mean, these are features of, you know, all routers, you know, Cisco routers, whatever, where you can enable policies as such that if somebody does this, you can put them into like a restricted network access mode where they can't have network access with the exception of voice over IP 911 calls.
Yeah.
You know, like you could not ensure that they're going to die if they have a house fire, but you could shut them off from everything else.
Well, that's true. I mean, I don't even think they should be allowed to cut off your phone service because you downloaded a bunch of stuff. Like, I mean, that's wrong. There was somebody else had an article about that, that there's a potential that, you know, oh, I may find out I come home and, I think there might have been an example where there was a guy who, in Seattle, he had hit the 250 gigabyte limit twice and he came home and his phone wasn't working, and here they'd shut his internet off. So what is it? Vonage? His Vonage wasn't working.
Yeah. I was looking through,
maybe
oh, yeah,
this one?
We're talking about that in about seven stories.
Oh, okay. That's why. Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's fine. It's good to bring up now because yeah, that did happen. The dude hit the 250 gigabyte cap twice. And, you know what, let's just talk about it now. We'll move it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's see, where is that article? So the article is from Wired. And Comcast bans a Seattle man from the internet for his cloudy ways. Basically, this dude did what every internet company wants you to do nowadays, is use the cloud for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he has, you know, he has photos, he did use Mozy for his backup service, and now he uses Carbonite because Mozy has a limit on how much you can back up. So all of his, you know, terabytes of data are getting backed up to the cloud. All of his video needs are YouTube, Netflix, Pandora for audio. He uses VoIP for his phone. Like, this dude really does what, you know, Apple is pushing for, what Microsoft is pushing for. Everybody's pushing to the cloud. This dude does it. And Comcast is like, no, you hit the limit twice. You're done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really? Really?
Yeah, it's not cool. I mean, I can understand maybe starting to throttle someone's connection, maybe, you know, if they're a really heavy user. But completely cutting them off, I just don't understand why they didn't need to do that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yes, you know, like the previous article said, they can do this. It's well within their rights. You know, nothing is preventing them from disconnecting somebody for violating their policies. But, luckily, the dude didn't have any emergencies or anything that he couldn't make a phone call. And really, that's why I don't use VoIP, you know, because I'm always worried about that, especially living where we live in Western Pennsylvania. A storm hits or something, everything could go out.
What I really wonder is, like, say I bought, like, I have a phone from Comcast, which I guess uses VoIP. I don't know if it uses, but I wonder if, like, I would, like, go over my allocation, if they would also shut off my Comcast TV and phone service as well.
it all comes over the same pipe, same literal cable.
There are different standards, but you know, the TV's not IP based, but well, some of it might be, but
it's the same cable. You know, it's
yeah.
It's,
but what are they gonna? But they could just block IP traffic.
They could
just shut off the DOCSIS signal.
But is it not IP?
What?
I mean, maybe you don't know it,
The TV?
Yeah.
No, TV's not IP. It's QAM.
Because you have on-demand stuff, right?
Well, the on-demand might be IP-based, but I don't even think that is. I think it's all QAM. So the back channel might be IP.
Yeah.
But even then, that's a different thing. Like, they might have different standards for it. Like,
well, yeah, I'm sure they have like muxers and stuff to, you know, take your three different things and mix it all into one.
Well,
and hit the backbone.
The cable
and whatever.
Modem, like the cable modem signal, runs at like 800 megahertz on the cable, and the back channel is at like 32 kilohertz or something, and that's how they do the, or 32 megahertz, yeah, and that's how they do the cable modem part of it. That's all part of the DOCSIS standard, and they're like separate from the TV channels. And then there's communications that go on between the cable box. For video on demand, I don't know if that uses the DOCSIS like cable modem standard, or if it's yet another protocol. So, like, to turn off your internet, they could just shut off the DOCSIS. But what I don't know is whether your phone runs over the DOCSIS connection on IP, or if it's tunneled a different way.
This is just my assumption, but I would assume it would, because they advertise it as voice over IP service.
Right, but so it still could be a separate standard, is what I'm saying. Like, you know,
it could
what I mean?
Be. I think they would be smart enough to not do that. Like, it seems like wasteful.
It does to me too.
Well, do you want to try it? Let's go download some stuff.
No thanks.
So, jumping back, our last general article, really not much to do with technology, but I found it interesting because I just got off of like six airplanes, and from CNN Travel, the TSA is taking their first steps toward implementing the Trusted Traveler program. Personally, I think this is just kind of like going back to the way it used to be.
Yeah.
You know, pre-9/11, they want to implement a program like that.
Yeah, I have a little concern, though. Like, they say if you answer some additional questions, you become a trusted traveler. I want to know what those questions are, what information they have on you, what they're going to keep, what it's used for.
Well, you know what? I mean, for people like us, like, we work at government contractors. That's no secret.
Yeah.
They have all our information. There's nothing they can ask me that they don't already have. You know, like, I'm not worried about that. They got it.
Well, there's also privacy acts that state that they're not allowed to disclose that to other organizations, and even within the government. So,
they know it is my point. Like, I'm
yeah,
not giving anything.
Yeah, they know it, but it's still, there's like, I can at least have some trust that a bureaucrat in one division of the federal government won't give my information out to somebody else,
right?
Because, you know, unless they have maybe criminal reasons to do so.
It's like the DOD has your information, they're not going to give it to DHS,
right? Or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, whatever that may be, because I think it's just OPM that does it for, you know, for security clearance.
And so they do it for everybody, really. Like, they're contracted out by everybody. They're not a part of one or the other, right?
OPM.
Yeah.
I think it's just a division of, like, probably Department of the Interior or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what they're a part of, but I thought they were contracted out by every department
maybe,
of whatever.
Is there, like, an employment one? I don't remember. But anyway, OPM is the guys that, you know,
that do all your background checking and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to look here real quick to see if it says anything, but nothing really that you can see right away. I'm not going to look into it anymore. I don't care. Yeah, my point is just that I feel like they have all my information. You
yeah,
know?
But what about people that don't? I mean, you know, what? I just don't think they need to be. I think, you know, there's they've called into question these scanners. I guess there's some reports that some of the TSA agents now like have been getting sick at work from these scanners.
From the new backscatter ones.
Yeah, and they're saying like it's possible like radiation poisoning. I read something like that. I haven't seen anything on it since. You know, who knows if it's just getting like not reported on because of all the stuff with Casey Anthony and all the other news stories going on about Rupert Murdoch. But, you know, like, what, I don't know why they're not reporting it, but I did read that. And, you know, the one good example I saw was that if, let's just say, let's do a, you know, theorize that they found out that these backscatter X-ray machines, you know, where they cured you of some disease, like let's just say if you had some kind of cancer and you were in this thing for 10 minutes, it killed the cancer. Your doctor would not be allowed to use it on you legally, could not use it on you to save your life because the FDA has not done any testing with these scanners. None. Zero, zip, zilch. There's no testing.
And even if they have, I think he still wouldn't be able to use it because they haven't tested it for that purpose.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that's the other thing. Like with the FDA, not only do you have to test it, the actual physical thing, you have to test it for the purpose it's intended.
Yeah, for each and every purpose.
Right. So,
Stupid FDA.
Yeah. Well,
I hate them.
I don't know. I don't think these things make us safer, and I think these pat downs are ridiculous. So I don't care about this trusted traveler program. I don't care about.
So you wouldn't answer a few more questions to be able to blow through a security line in 1 minute rather than an hour?
That's besides the point. I may do it, but I don't think I should have to. You know.
Oh, I totally agree with that. Yeah.
Because in every single instance that we've had since 9/11 and since all these security procedures, like the underwear bomber, the Christmas bomber, the shoe bomber, all these people that have attempted things, they all made it on the plane.
Right.
And several other people have made it on the plane that were on the do not fly list, and they still made it on the plane. There's a problem. There's a bigger problem beyond the security theater at
the security checkpoints hasn't done anything.
Yeah.
Have they caught anybody?
I haven't
heard anything.
I mean, yeah, maybe they kept some knives off planes and some guns off plane, but who said those people were going to do anything bad with them?
Right.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's probably, I think it is a federal crime to carry a firearm on a plane, but that's besides the point. Like, okay, yeah, they prevented somebody from carrying on the plane. I guess they prevented a crime, but that in and of itself is a rights restriction versus an actual crime of like using the gun in a illegal manner.
Right.
So anyway.
Yeah, and they don't even know if this is going to be a real program. You know, they're just taking the first steps and seeing what people are going to think about it. But let's take a turn. We have a lot of social networking stories, and the first four kind of all mashed together, so we don't need to talk about them individually. I'll just quickly go over. They all deal with Google and Google Plus. So we talked about Google Profiles a while ago, and this was before Google Plus came out. You know, Google had this profile section. You could go and fill out all the information on yourself. It was kind of like your, you know, like a Facebook landing page. People could go and find your information. Well, if your Google profile is private, it's gone in about a week and a half. They're trying to force everybody to use Google Plus. And in addition to getting rid of private Google profiles, they're also retiring Blogger and Picasa, the brands. They're not necessarily getting rid of the technology because, you know, Picasa has been integrated into Google Plus as the picture manager, mm-hmm. and Blogger, I don't know what they're going to do with that. But
I think they're just rebranding it Google Photos and Google Blog.
Are they?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're making a lot of big changes in addition to, you know, what they're actually listening to their users. You know, they have a big send feedback button on the right-hand side of Google Plus, and they've received and they read, you know, every comment, complaint, question, and last week they started implementing some stuff and they're going to continue to do it. What do you think about, let's just talk about Google Plus in general, you know, have you used it a lot? What do you think of it in terms of how they're going about social?
I signed up. They finally approved me and I was able to use it and find some friends on there.
We're not Google Plus friends, are we?
Yeah, we are.
Are we?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Here's what I've seen. Basically, like, there's a lot of, like, segmentation. So, for instance, like, I wanted to put something on my Google Plus, like, you know, wall. I don't know what it's
called.
Your
stream.
The stream. And I'm like, oh, I guess I just go plus one things, like, and that's how it puts on there. Well, that doesn't put on your stream.
Nope.
That puts it in your plus one tab in your Google profile. So I didn't understand that exactly. So the other thing that I was like, I'm like, all right, well, maybe if I buzz, it'll put it up there too. Buzz doesn't do it.
Yeah, buzz is going away pretty much.
Yeah, but it's like, why? Why not just like, if you buzz, just throw it in your stream? I don't understand.
I think they want to get rid of buzz just because it's duplicated technology now.
Well, it might be, but like, why is it separate? Like, how hard would it be to just take all the buzz posts
and put them
in your stream? Like, for the time being, so at least it makes sense while it's still there.
Right.
Or don't even put it in there at all.
Get rid of the buzz link.
That's a novel idea. Get rid of the buzz link. So I don't understand how you share articles other than just like copy the link, go over to Google Plus, paste the link into your like stream.
That's what I've seen so far.
Right. Yeah. Which I guess it works, but it's just like they need something better. You got to give me like a little JavaScriptlet thing, bookmarklet that you put up there that I can hit and bam, it'll push it just like Facebook has.
And you know what? They'll probably do that sometime soon.
Yeah, but it's like, I guess some of this stuff just seems, I didn't see anything there that's compelling.
Well,
I'm not saying that it won't get better.
Oh, right.
Like, there's nothing there. The circles, I'm not sure. I think it's a good idea, but I don't know how it's going to affect me.
See, here's what I think is compelling. Here's what I like about it. As far as the circles go, I like the circles. I need to make more of them. I need to actually do it. I haven't done it yet. I just have the defaults right now. I see that as useful because, you know, I want to have circles within circles, you know, nested circles. That way, whenever I choose to blast out information, I can just blast to one circle and it hits everybody, or blast to another circle and it hits everybody but my family if I want to share something I don't want them to see, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, so nested circles would be nice. What I like about Google Plus, though, is it's every social network in one. It's your Facebook because you have the stream, you have friends. It's Twitter because you can follow people who you're not friends with. So it's exactly like Twitter. And it is also exactly like Foursquare because they have a check-in feature. So Google has taken every social network that people use on a day-to-day basis, put it all in one thing.
Yeah, but see, I think Facebook has all those too. Facebook has the Facebook aspect of it. They have check-ins with the places, which works on pretty much all the phone apps.
Right.
And they have pages, which are basically a way for a celebrity to set something up for someone to quote-unquote follow.
Right, right.
But they're not following them. They're just like liking the page or whatever. Right. It's the same thing. I mean,
it is.
It's just different names.
But you know what Google Plus doesn't have that Facebook does? Farmville.
Yeah, I mean, there's that aspect. The app platform isn't there yet in Google Plus.
That's what I'm hoping doesn't get there.
Well, maybe it won't, and that's fine. You know, and it might sort of just like segment. That might be the differentiating factor. It's really just about social sharing,
right?
Versus gaming and everything else and all that. But they're going to have to monetize. They're probably not going to monetize these in an ad-based way like the way Facebook has. They're just going to use all this information to sell better advertising elsewhere.
Right. I mean,
that's definitely the purpose. But this could bite them too if people just choose not to share things. Like, and I don't know like what the I didn't really read down into the details on the terms of service if. Like, no matter who I share this with, Google gets to use it no matter what in terms of, like, you know, doing, like, data forensics on it. Or yeah,
I got to tell you, just like everything else, I didn't read them at all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I usually, like, peruse them, but I didn't get down in the weeds on it, you know, and it, anyway, I'm still, like, open-minded on it. I'm not like, oh, this sucks. It's never going to beat Facebook. I'm sure it has a fighting chance. I haven't seen anything that's floored me yet.
Yeah, nothing has floored me. I've seen things, like, I want to use it. I want to use it so bad because it takes three services and puts it in one for me. I want the mobile app to get a little better, to be able to work in a different way. I want an easier way to post things, you know, via text message or email. They don't have that aspect yet, like Twitter does, like Facebook does. And I want more flexibility with circles, you know, nested circles. If they can do that, I will switch to Google Plus. Right now, I will still, you know, set up some sort of plugin or whatever. When I post to Google Plus, it shoots it to Twitter, shoots it to Facebook. I'll still do that to keep those around. But I really want to use Google Plus, and I'm not right now because there are just a few things keeping me from it. But it seems that Facebook really does think that they're a threat because they have banned not only an ad for Google Plus, but a user who said, you know, who made the ad, hey, find me on Google Plus. Here's the link to my Google Plus profile. Gone. The dude wrote on Google Plus, I recently ran a Google Plus advertisement on Facebook that got all of my campaigns suspended. So not just that single ad, any ad he ever ran, taken off of Facebook completely. Isn't there some kind of law against this, like anti-competitive things?
It's hard to say because it's on their property, you know, essentially.
Yeah, but I mean, unless you're doing something illegal, they can't take it down because you're paying. Do you pay for Facebook ads?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, if it's an... Oh, I see. It's an ad. I thought it was just he put it in his profile.
No, this is an ad. This dude bought an ad to show up, you know, to his friends that says, find me on Google+.
Yeah, maybe in this case, it's a little... That one probably is a little on the borderline there. If he paid like cold hard cash for this ad, I mean, maybe they refunded his money.
Oh, that could be. Yeah, I still think Facebook should go to jail for that.
Just Mark.
Yeah. But also banned from Google Plus, Anonymous. Our good friends Anonymous, and now they have their own version of Google Plus called Anon Plus.
So creative.
Seriously, love it, guys. Love it.
Why not Anon Book?
Ooh, Anon Book. Or what about a Anon Space or Mynonymous? I like Mynonymous. I don't have anything to say about this. Like, I think it's stupid.
I don't want my account hacked. So.
That's okay. I do not think it's stupid. This is the best thing ever.
Go Anonymous. Go you.
Yeah. But just the whole point of other people making their own copies of Google Plus, like, I mean, I guess we saw that with Facebook when Facebook hit big. We saw that with Twitter. You know, what was that other one?
Here's what I don't get about this Anon Plus thing. Like, they want to remain anonymous, but they're creating, like, a place where they're all, like, you know.
Well, they could put their anonymous, what's the word I'm looking for? Their.
Like, persona?
Yes. They're a not quote-unquote anonymous persona, whatever their hacker name is or whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, it just seems like it would give authorities like a place to mine data from. I think it's probably just a joke.
It's a honeypot.
Yeah.
They're trying to lure the government in.
That's what I think it probably is.
So did you hear that, FBI and CIA? Anonplus.com is a honeypot. That probably just got my internet shut off. I'm sure I'm being hacked right now. Even though this isn't streaming live, they have tapped into my network. But an article that doesn't talk so much about Google Plus, this one's about Apple, comes to us from the Boy Genius Report, that Apple's top patent lawyer quits just as Apple is suing everybody.
Yeah, I found this really interesting because they just like launched this huge wave of suits against HTC, and there's the ongoing like trade dress suit with Samsung.
Yeah,
and
I mean, literally everybody. Do
you think it's because he had like ethical like objections to it, or do you think it was like he just, you know, thought it was stupid, or maybe they weren't doing enough suing, or I mean, what?
Or maybe he thinks he wasn't getting paid enough to sue these big companies, you know, 30 yeah. million suits. Yeah, do we know where he went? I don't think. At least this article from Boy Genius Report doesn't say where he went, but I don't know if anybody else said where he went. I don't know where he went.
Yeah, me either.
But that would be interesting if he's like, you know what? I think Samsung could win this. I'm going to go work for Samsung.
Oh, well, the guy they're bringing in formerly worked for Hewlett Packard. I did read that, but
yeah,
it's, I don't know. It sounds fishy. I mean,
it's very fishy.
All these patent cases, I mean, it's a quagmire. I mean, I don't know what they're going
to
do.
Yeah, I mean, Apple, I believe it was Apple that tried to clean it up a little bit in that they, quote-unquote, dropped all of their suits against HTC and rolled them all into one. So now instead of being in court six times, they're only in court one time for all six items.
I think that was the flip-flop. I think they said about HTC dropping suit, but really what it was HTC.
Was that what it was?
Yeah, they're the ones that refiled, or Samsung are one of them.
Yeah, some company in this big debacle, you know, dropped six suits to roll up those six things into one big suit.
Yeah, that might have been, it's one of the Android phone makers, I believe.
Yeah, so they're trying to clean it up a little bit, but I agree with you. It's very fishy that Apple's big shot patent lawyer is gone right in the middle of this.
Yeah.
I don't think Apple's going to have a problem winning them just because I think they probably have 1,000 lawyers, you know, on hand to take care of this. One guy's not going to make that big of a deal. But we'll see. I want Apple to win. Of course I do. Why would I not want Apple to win? Our last social article, Ryan, you actually sent this to me. It comes from the Washington Post. Something about somebody screwing up a hashtag in a tweet?
What? Oh, yeah. So Entenmann's, Entenmann's, they're a bakery.
They have a display at the end of the aisle.
Yeah, at the end of the aisle?
That was a quote from Seinfeld.
Oh.
They went to buy an Entenmann's cake, and they're like, Entenmann's? And he's like, yeah, there's a thing at the end of the aisle.
Oh, I don't remember that one. But anyway, they're like a bakery, and they make, you know, they make baked goods like Hostess and all the other companies. Apparently, they... Right after the not guilty verdict came out for the Casey Anthony trial, they had posted something on Twitter with a pound not guilty, a pound not guilty tweet, and it like totally like back, it was like a backlash against them. Now, they're denying that it had anything to do with the Casey Anthony trial. They said it was more about like they're not guilty was like not guilty for like eating sweets. It was something to do with that.
Yeah, eating. What did they don't even list the tweet here in the article.
Yeah, I guess they deleted it. Yeah. So no one, I don't know if anyone actually knows what it actually was. I'm sure Twitter does, but so anyway, it's just pretty interesting that you know.
I guess this
the cautiousness that you have to take
seriously
when diving into social media. If it really was like a, you know, unintended. Oh wait, there are not.
No,
those are the responses.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the tweet that they actually wrote. Oh, here it is. Who's hash not guilty about eating all the tasty treats they want?
Oh, that to me, that does not sound like they were in any way
no.
referencing the trial.
No, they were not trying
so
to make light
totally
of
it. So this was totally an unfortunate coincidence. Yeah.
And honestly, I have some friends, one in particular that I won't name. Ryan, you know who he is, who freaking hashtags everything.
Okay.
And this is just something that some people do.
Yeah.
You know, if they have a feeling that they want to impart on a tweet, they just hashtag whatever they're feeling and that goes in the tweet. So this is...
Yeah. Well, I think this was to like start some, you know... Start some tweets about like eating tasty treats.
Right. Getting people, you know, every time you see the not guilty hashtag, people will think Entenmann's. You know? I think this is completely stupid that they had to apologize for this.
Well, not only that, she is not guilty, right? Like they found her not. So how is it insensitive?
Well, it's insensitive because she is clearly guilty, you know, and the world hates her and is probably going to kill her in the next 2 days if they find her.
Well, how is she clearly guilty? A jury.
Okay, I didn't watch the whole thing. I just read articles
about
it.
Well, me either. I don't want this to turn into Casey, because we have one other story related to this. Not because I'm in any way, I haven't watched any of the case.
Yeah, I haven't either. But apparently, you know, she's clearly guilty to any sane person, but they didn't have the exact specific type of evidence that a jury needed in order to make a conviction.
Concrete evidence?
Well, it was something... It was all like circumstantial stuff.
Yeah, circumstantial evidence can't put you away.
But to any sane person, you knew.
But it's got to be beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Right, and that's what they didn't have, even though everybody knew she was
guilty.
Now, there
could be a civil case. I mean, that's what happened to O.J. Simpson. He was acquitted in the criminal case, but then he was... Because in a civil case, it's based on a preponderance of the evidence. That's a much different level.
If the glove does not fit, you must acquit.
So, but anyway, I just think it's unfortunate. It just be careful the perils of social media.
Yeah, seriously. Go search for hashtags before you use them.
Yeah.
Stupid. Our next article from Reuters. We have a couple security articles for you. This one has to do with jailbreaking. There was an exploit for, a zero-day exploit, I should add, for iOS, iPad, iPhone, that the site jailbreak.me, you probably know this if you've ever heard of them. They were the first people to make a website where you browse the website on your phone, and the website had a slider unlock bar like mm-hmm. the iPhone does, except it said slide to jailbreak, mm-hmm. and the website exploited your phone and jailbroke your phone with the flick of a finger. Mm-hmm. They were the first site to do that. Well, they did it again with the updated OS that exploited a PDF vulnerability. And funny thing, we don't have the other articles in here because I just wanted to mention them. So they did this a few days. Apple releases 4.3.4 that fixes this vulnerability. And like a minute later, they break another thing. So the new iOS is already jailbroken again. Uh-huh. I just wanted to mention that. I don't know if you have anything else to say about that. I just thought it was kind of a funny thing.
It surprises me in some ways that Steve Jobs hasn't like cracked down on this, like for everything else that's so like anal about that company.
What can he do though? I mean, you know, like what kind of crackdown could he do?
Well, I mean, is it theoretically possible to build an unbreakable system?
No, if you have the hardware in your hands, you
well,
can
the
do-
the hard. Okay, so there's really, I mean, but with from a software standpoint, if your only interfaces are software, Can you jailbreak it?
But that's, in theory, no. I mean, yes, because there's always going to be exploits that people don't know about. You know, no coder is perfect.
Well, right, but if they really controlled the code base, I mean, I don't know.
I mean, maybe
I am not a like theoretical security expert, but like it seems to me like I understand like if you have the hardware, you can like, you know, you can like freeze it, catch the stuff in memory, and do all the like logic analysis.
Well, either way, I mean, general rule of thumb, if you have physical access, you have access.
Right.
Period. You know, so you have physical access to the iPhone, you therefore have physical access to the software that is on the iPhone, therefore you can do whatever you want.
I just mean, could they prevent these like third-party ways of doing it? In the sense that...
Oh, all like you via have, a website or something.
Right, right. That it makes it for the user where really the user's not doing it. They're
right.
Just going to this website. They tell the website to do it, and then the website does it.
And that's how all jailbreaking happens. You know, nobody
right.
jailbreaks things. People release a tool, you click a couple buttons, and bam.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think they could prevent that.
Yeah.
The standard way a jailbreak works now is that you physically have to, you know, use a tool, put your device into maintenance mode or restore mode, so you have to hold a couple buttons for a certain number of seconds in the right order, and then the tool can do the rest of the job.
Oh, okay. So yeah. This isn't literally just go to this website, slide this
for
thing.
For that website, it is.
Oh,
because of the exploit. Yeah.
Oh.
But the standard.
But that's been closed though, right? That one.
That one has been closed.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that was an exploit in.
So
the
I
way
guess it, that's what I'm getting at is like, could they do it such that you'd always need to do some sort of hardware interrupt. In addition,
I'm sure they could if they tightly controlled everything. Yeah, because this was the way iOS handles PDFs.
Because that would prevent like 99.99% of people from ever trying it because most people just don't have the. If you don't give them a link to do it, they're not going to take the time to do it.
That's why I didn't do it for the longest time because I didn't know how to do it. I didn't want to brick my phone.
Yeah.
And even when I did decide that I needed to do this, the instructions were kind of vague. Even though I watched videos on how to do it, and I was still a little leery, like I didn't know if I was going to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not easy, you know. It's not something anybody can just pick up and jailbreak if you have to do it the standard way. So yeah, very interesting. Our next article from Microsoft. This is actually on the WindowsTeamBlog.com site, Windows Live. There's a whole. The title of the article: Hey, my friend's account was hacked. And it's this big article about account hijacking. But the main point of this article that I wanted to point out is that Hotmail, you know, Microsoft services, you know how services have always put that little password strength meter when you sign up for a new account, you type your password, it says, oh, this is secure, this is medium secure, this is a not secure password. It kind of checks it as you type. Well, now Microsoft is not only doing that, but they are disallowing easy passwords. If I was to go and sign up for Hotmail and enter in password as my password, they will not let me sign up for an account. If I was to enter, they give a quote, I love cats as my password, they would not let me sign up for an account. Like they will check your password to see how easy it is to be broken. And if they can break it, they deny you access.
Hmm.
So I think that is awesome that Microsoft is taking this step.
Yeah, the thing is, though, like I remember reading an article about like the whole password complexity thing and that over time it's going to become inordinately difficult to create a password that can't be hacked.
It's a good thing you brought that up because you know Steve Gibson.
Yeah.
Right? So he just came out with a thing called Password Haystacks, I believe, is his theory on secure passwords. And, you know, he did all the math. You know what? Let me do a quick search real quick. Gibson password... Haystack. And he basically proved that as long as you have the, you know, like three different things, it's not. Okay. So here's an example of a password. Here's one that is capital D, zero, lowercase g, spells dog with some special characters, and then like 15 periods. That password is more secure than the password below it, which is literally random junk. So it's literally password length. You know, he says here, the most important factor is password length, because for every character that you have, it makes it exponentially harder to crack because there are more things to try. So, you know, you could have dog and 15 periods, and that's a perfectly secure, not crackable in the next millennia password.
Yeah, I mean, I understand what he's saying, but I thought I've also read that this whole, like, length thing, though, is a losing game. Because like, at the rate at which technology increases, because the way it's been recently is, like, I know with, like, some security systems, or high security systems, the password requirements have gone from, like, you know, 8 to 10 to 12 to 14 to 16 in only a couple years. They keep upping them every couple years.
Right.
So, like, I don't know.
Yeah, he has a calculator on here. I'm going to enter that password and see how long it says. Yeah, so, okay. So I just entered the password capital D, zero, little g, dog. So let's see. The offline attack. So online attack, assuming 1,000 guesses per second, that can be cracked in 4 minutes. And, you know, if it's offline, if you have access to a password file, like a SAM file or something, you know, less than a second. But watch what happens when I add dots. I add one dot up to 22 hours for an online attack. Add another dot, 3 months. Add another dot, 23 years for an online attack.
Right, but again, he's holding the number of tries constant.
1,000 guesses per second, which is pretty good for today's current hardware.
Right, but he's still cracking in a massive cracking array scenario with your password.
Right, 100 trillion guesses a second.
Right, it's cracked in...
But there, I mean, there's a, what is it, 13-character password, 1.6500 centuries. That's if you have a freaking Beowulf cluster attacking a SAM file offline. It's a 13-character password, and you are good for the rest of your effort.
Right, but this is assuming brute force, though. Can't this... Doesn't like, password salts and, like, rainbow tables change all this?
Only... No, because rainbow tables are used to capture common things. Like, rainbow tables are literally just passwords matched with their hashes. You know, normal, everyday, what attackers have already seen. So if my password is, you know, dog with 13 periods at the end... A rainbow table could only crack it fast if dog with 13 periods was in the table along with its hash.
Right.
It could do the match and then find it.
But here's another example. Let's say people start to use this this type of password. Like, couldn't the password cracking algorithms be changed such that, okay, I'm going to, like, crack the first few characters, and then the first special character that I see, the period, I'm going to try repeating after that.
Just, like, try it a bunch of times.
Yeah, because
yeah, totally
if that becomes a standard... I mean, I understand what he's trying to say, that the length is more secure, but people aren't going to remember 16-character passwords if they don't have a lot of repeating elements in them.
Right. And
a lot of password enforcement rules disallow repeating characters of so many, you know, they'll do that. They'll look at how many times.
Yeah, and here's what he says to do. So I'm going to give an example of a password. I don't use this for anything, so... You know, feel free to try it if you want on my accounts, but it's not going to work. So I'm going to spell my last name with special characters. So $ pipe zero NK @. So if every one of my passwords is like this, Slonka in Leet speak - the name of the site, and then 10 periods. Bam, 6.34 million trillion centuries. So for
off, the Amazon could be inferred by the site that they're trying to hack.
Right, if you did it like this. Yeah, this is a poor way to do it.
Oh, okay.
But he's just saying, you know, have a password which is, you know, ridiculous, but you can remember it, and then have something that changes per site.
Yeah.
You know, and then put some padding, whether it's a bunch of dots or whatever.
Yeah.
But and from what he seems to say, if you have, like, those three elements, you know, something you know, something that changes per site, and then some padding somewhere, whether it's at the beginning, in the middle, at the end, you know, 1.7900 centuries for a 14-character password, in the best case, 18 trillion centuries if they're trying to attack you on a server like Hotmail that's online. You know, that's ridiculous.
But that's assuming that they try every password. They still could just randomly guess it.
Oh, there's always... Yeah. The serendipitous moment where, bam, you try something and it works.
So, I mean, I don't know. Like, it just... If they can detect patterns in passwords and then they start to, like, you know, write an algorithm around the patterns that people are using...
Right.
They might be able to break these passwords apart and then start to crack them easier. I don't...
And for some things, like, I believe Windows, I think Windows still stores its passwords as two separate hashes. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, once you get past a certain number of characters, it goes to a method where the first eight characters are one hash, the second eight characters are another hash, so it's easier to break because it's two separate smaller things. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's exactly how they do it, but it's something like that. And yeah, you're right. I mean, if
well, the reason I say this is like, what? Why don't we have systems that like what would there be a benefit to having very simple passwords, but one try fault?
No, I would be locked out of everything.
Right, but you can always enter your second factor authentication in and reset your password. You know what I mean? Like, if everybody provides like resettable second factor,
right.
You know, backdoor key for you that you like that's personally identifiable information that no one would have,
right?
Or something like that, or just even like a second password. Like maybe you every website you make two passwords for, and it's one try access. Here's an example. Maybe you have a safe password, okay? And the safe password, you never change it. But as soon as it gets used, it locks the account and you have to call in or something. So that way they know, you know, it'll unlock it in the case of a locked password, but if it's not locked, it locks it. It's almost like a dual lock system.
Right.
So, you know, that way there's no way that I mean, yeah, sure, they could possibly guess your password on the first try, maybe. But they don't know which one they're guessing. If it's the fail-safe password or if it's the actual one.
If it's the fail-safe password, bomb goes off.
Right. Bomb goes off, you got to call support. If it's not the fail-safe password and they happen to guess it on the first try, that would be the odds of that would be crazy high.
Right.
You know, now that's not to say that there might not be people would like go and use password as their password, but like and there could be really common things to guess on the first try.
Yeah.
But I think most people I don't think any of my passwords, even my simplest ones, would be guessable on the first try because they have nothing to do with me.
Yeah, that's how my passwords are. You know, I used a password for the longest time that only had numbers and lowercase letters, and it still wasn't a word. Like, it made sense to me, but nobody's going to guess it.
Right.
You know?
So that's what I mean. Like, I wonder if a method like that is better than, like, all these like crazy password scenarios where you know just like a better scheme like that if you
but
know
but in that case brute force works better. Easy passwords brute force can take down.
No, that's the problem. If it's one try access.
Oh, you're still going on the one try thing. Okay.
Yeah, if it's one try where like the account locks if you mess up the password, it locks the account and then you have your fail-safe password.
See, I think that's good. I like that idea.
The only problem there is if they get access to the actual tables.
I was going
to
say, that doesn't help for an offline attack.
Right. But that there may be another way to protect against that. I mean,
Right. So implement the one-try thing for online to prevent online attacks and have some other mechanism for the offline attacks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's got to be a better way. Why haven't...
Because I just think this is a losing game. If you looked at... I'd have to look at the running time. But if you assume the computers are going to go along a...
Moore's law,
you know, do passwords keep pace or not with length?
Right.
To where it becomes literally, you know, you've got to write a book. And then it's not, you know, there's a point at which password length becomes inarduously long. You know, I'd say even at like, once you start hitting like 16 characters, it's just like...
crazy.
You know, unless you do this repeating character thing. So yeah. Anyway...
Yeah, sorry, I was just looking through the source of his page to see if he had the JavaScript in the page itself. I wanted to see what math he did to figure out those calculations, if I could easily change it, you know, to say for a 15 billion core processor. Mm-hmm. But no, it's in some external file and I'm not going to go looking for it. So let's stop talking about passwords. Let's talk about another vulnerability. Skype, a dangerous vulnerability. Cross-site scripting flaw that could be used to change the password on someone's account has been found in Skype. Skype has said, we don't care. Basically, they say that the only way that this is a real attack is if somebody is knowingly talking to an attacker and then they can run the flaw on you while you're talking to them. Well, has this person actually talked to 13-year-olds nowadays? Because these kids will get on video chat with anybody. Have you been to Stick'em.com or Ustream? They will talk to anybody on video chat. Like, really. And my big thing here is, what does this have to do with Facebook? Because Facebook now partners with Skype.
Yeah.
So if Skype is vulnerable, Facebook is vulnerable. There are so many virus and malware attacks on Facebook. Like, why do you, can you think of any reason why they're not making this into more of a bigger deal?
I really don't know. I mean, I don't know why they just don't patch it and then be done with it.
I mean, they're probably going to do that eventually, but you would think a flaw like this would be on their radar. Like, you know, this would be a...
I guess it's just something that somebody can't do subversively.
Right, you can't just go do it to anybody.
Because it takes, like, specific actions.
You need to call somebody first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I just think this is a problem because people accept anybody as friends on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Facebook now uses Skype for video calls. You know, therefore, somebody can exploit anybody very easily. Yeah. But whatever, we'll see what happens. It's probably already patched. So, our last article of the day comes from CNET again. CNET's a pretty good place for some news. But Department of Justice says, we can force you to decrypt your laptop. So this has been something for the longest time where if you're going through the airport, you have your laptop, you know, they would always, not always, but they would sometimes make people power on their laptop and, you know, check to make sure they're not trying to steal information, pass it, you know, through the country, if you're traveling back and forth, whatever. And for the longest time, it was always if you had hard drive encryption, or even just encrypted files on your laptop, they could not force you to give them your password to decrypt the stuff. Well, that is still the case. However, the Department of Justice now is saying, we don't want your password, but we're going to make you enter your password so that we can see the files that you encrypted. So yeah. It seems like they're skirting that whole, Bill of Rights action where you don't have to incriminate yourself by giving out your password because you don't have to give it out anymore. You just have to decrypt your files. I remember last time we talked about this, you were way more intense about this whole encryption thing than I was. Do you have any?
Well, I think they're going to have there's going to be a long hill for them to climb to get to this point because an example would be if I had a diary. I'm fairly certain that a diary is not admissible in court, I think.
Why though?
To incriminate you.
How are you comparing that to an encrypted hard drive?
Well, I think you're basically your activities on a computer are basically a diary.
Okay.
That's one example, but
I kind of liken this. I think they can do this. I always thought they could make people give them their password anyways because, you know, if you're wanted for something and they come into your house, they can take anything that's in your house. You can't tell them not to take it. So this is kind of the same deal. I mean, right? You know, if you're suspect for stealing government information and they want you to decrypt your laptop... Sure, they don't have a subpoena at the moment, but they can get one, and they can make you decrypt your stuff. It seems like this is well within their rights to do. I don't like it, but it seems like they would be able to do this.
Now, I guess, so diaries are admissible in court.
Yeah,
about this, though? Let's say your diary was in a secret place, and the court knew about it, knew that you had a diary. Could they legally make you go get the diary, but not tell them where you hid it? That's about the same.
That's true. That's, I don't know if they can do that.
Yeah, that's really the paradigm here.
Although, if they're coming to search your house, they're finding your diary.
Yeah, but what if it's not your house?
They're finding everything you've ever had your name on. They're going to your bank. They're going to your backyard.
But they can't get into a security deposit box, can they?
They can subpoena the bank, be like, he's in a criminal investigation. Give us all his stuff.
I was under the impression that security deposit boxes were like, you couldn't be opened.
Really?
I mean, without force.
Well, I mean, like...
They'd have to cut it open. Maybe they could.
The bank has a key.
I thought only you had the key. I thought it was like a dual key thing where you had both keys. I don't know. I've never had one.
So I haven't either, yeah.
Well, anyway, it's interesting case law. I mean, I personally think that you should not be able to be coerced into giving up any information on yourself. That's what the Fifth Amendment's for. If they can't get the information on their own from somebody else, if there's not evidence elsewhere that you have done wrongdoing, then I don't think that they have really a case.
Yeah, they're trying to. The University of Chicago legal forum, you know, basically says that they can't force an individual to disclose the comments of your mind, which is basically what it is, because a password is memorized, not written down.
Yeah, you could just say, oh, I forgot. Yeah. But the thing about that is,
that's a lie then.
It's a lie, and if they could prove it's a lie, they could get you on perjury.
Yeah. Yeah, so if, as long as you don't have your password written down, if it's committed only to memory and nowhere else, they can't force you to disclose the contents of your mind. But what if they put you on the stand, you're under oath, you perjure yourself if you don't tell them the contents of your mind? Whether you say it's a lie
but
or
all
not.
You have to do is, no, all you have to do is say, I plead the fifth. That's your legal right. You can say, I plead the fifth. You don't have to answer yes or no to any question.
Isn't pleading the fifth, though, in the case of incriminating yourself for something further, not for the thing that you're being tried on? Like, if you're already being tried on something, you have to tell them everything.
No. If you, let's say you're on trial for murdering somebody, and you go up to the stand and they say, you know, did you use a gun to kill this person? I'm pretty sure you can say I plead the fifth.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I always thought it was that you know, if you were on trial for murder, they suspect me of doing it with you, and I was on the stand and they asked me a question that would prove that I was there with you, I could plead the fifth because I'm incriminating myself in something I'm not on trial for.
No, I think it's in all cases. Really? I think it works on all cases.
Well, in that case.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see how this pans out, whether the DOJ has any clause or not. I'm sure they have clause. They could just go take it to the NSA and they'll decrypt the stuff for you. So that's the last of our articles. Did you have anything else that you saw?
Actually, yeah. So this is another article on the Casey Anthony trial. And the only reason I bring this up is it was interesting. They used some data mining software on, I guess, her computer to find out how many times she had searched for a word, I guess, chloroform. And the original report asserted there's two types of software used. The one type of software says she searched for it once. The other type said she searched for it 84 times.
Oh.
Okay. That was the evidence that was used in the case, that she had searched for it 84 times. Well, sometime in June, the maker of that software, after he had heard that his competitor's software only said that she's found it once, thought it in best interests, because someone's life was in the balance, he went back and looked at the algorithm that his code used, and sure enough, there was an error. He recalculated and found that the other software had an error as well in the way that it reported it, but it still resulted in the same answer. She only searched for it one time.
What kind of error?
I don't know.
Multiplies by 84.
Well, you know how caches are weird.
I know,
browser
yeah.
cache. But the thing is, he notified the DA office in Orange County and the sheriff and all this, and they did not listen to him. They never brought this up in the case that it was only one time. I think it's moot now, but he's right. Now coming out and saying, hey, I did tell them this and they didn't listen to me. He pleaded with them to, like, you know, reconsider that evidence, and they wouldn't.
They don't have to, though, right? I mean, was he put on the
Yeah, he was put on the stand. And
do things you say after you're off the stand matter?
Well, I don't think they asked him that specific question, and he's not allowed to make a statement on the stand.
But I mean, like, once you're on the stand, let's say they did ask him that question, and he gave an answer that he thought was right, but after he got off the stand, he was done.
I think this was, he found out, was still still subpoenaed, and they only asked him questions about the original report, and he wasn't able to answer any questions to say that, because you're not allowed to just start talking. You have to answer you can't be a hostile witness. Right. You have to answer the questions of lawyers,
right,
and what the judge tells you to answer. So he answered their questions, but they never asked him about the second, you know, that's the impression I got from the article. Nonetheless, it was never brought up at trial. It was never brought up to the judge. so there's they this is from the New York Times. They actually called the DA's office and they haven't answered any of their questions yet. It's interesting though, and the reason I bring this up is that I think this is a danger of using software as like this is sometimes this I don't know what this would be considered. If this is circumstantial or if this would actually be physical evidence on a computer. But this is the danger.
Physical.
Yeah, this is the danger, I think, in how you look at the data on a computer, because you must fully understand the data structures involved to know what's going on with the data. And they apparently didn't.
Yeah, and a similar thing, you know, now that you bring up software in the courtroom, you know, this has happened before with people, one specific person on trial for DUI. And he said, you know, you can't arrest or you can't put me in jail unless we verify that the breathalyzer, the algorithm that the breathalyzer uses, is computing it correctly.
Yeah, so he had to get the source
code. He got the source code and was able to prove that it had an error.
Yeah.
And they had to throw it out.
Yeah,
so I mean, all of you listening, you're obviously tech people, but if you're not and you're one of those people that stays away from tech, tech is everywhere whether you want it to be or not. You know, it's in the courtroom. It's in software. People use this in breathalyzers. Everything has software nowadays.
But the thing is, like, if they're making mistakes in a browser cache with this, just think of, like, the mistakes that the analysis software that looks at, like, IP traffic to find people that are doing...
File sharing,
copyright infringement, all these stuff. I think this calls into question a lot of that the way that data is collected. Maybe... fine to kick you off a network, but definitely not to prosecute you, and certainly not criminally.
Yeah.
It's one thing to, you know, say you breached a contract and sue you for money. That's a tort. It's another to say it's a crime. And I think there's a big distinction there that's not made anymore.
Yeah, and it's almost like if you go to on trial for something, you have to be a software engineer just to get off.
Yeah.
Seriously. So that is everything for this week's episode of the Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slonghack. You can also find me on Google Plus now. So search for me on Google Plus. Ryan, where can people find you?
I'm also on Google Plus, but I don't know if I'm searchable. I have no idea. You can find me at www.lancipedia.com or on Twitter at /RyanLancy.
And next week's episode will be Slongcast episode 40. So if you want us to talk about an article, bookmark it on Delicious as Slongcast040. We will make sure to talk about it. If you have a question for us, send an email to slongcast@kevinslonka.com, and we will do our best to answer whatever technical question you have. We love answering your questions, hearing your comments, seeing what you have to say. So with that being said, Dovidzhenya!